During the Second World War, brethren, my father was in his late teens. And after he had graduated from school, he wanted to serve in the RAF. So he went down to a recruiting station and asked to join. But they turned him down because he was too young. The next day he went to another recruiting station and lied about his age. And so he was able to enter the RAF, and he became, after a period of time, a sergeant air gunner, flying an American Catalina, a reconnaissance aircraft, over the channel and down the Bay of Biscay, also down to Gibraltar and the Mediterranean. But there came a day when he met with his death. The Catalina was crippled and was able to make it back all the way to Plymouth in England. But my father, the bottom half of his body was shot up from the machine gun fire that had penetrated the plane. He was still alive when they landed on the water, because the Catalina is an amphibious craft, and he actually drowned, but he was unconscious when he did so. The pilot traveled north in England to visit with my family, and told them that really it was an act of mercy that he was allowed to die through drowning, because he would have been crippled for the rest of his life. After his death, some of his medals, or all of his medals rather, and some things were sent from the government to my parents. Among them was this scroll that was sent to all those who gave their lives during the Second World War. It has the emblem of the royal family at the top of it. And it says, "This scroll commemorates," and then it would put in red the name of the person and their rank and the service with which they served, in this case the Royal Air Force. "This scroll commemorates," and the name of the person, "held in honor as one who served king and country in the World War of 1939 to 1945 and gave his life to save mankind from tyranny. May his sacrifice help to bring the peace and the freedom for which he died." They also sent, or I believe the pilot was the one that brought them to my relatives, these two logbooks of my father. And the last time I was in England, the relatives gave them to me so that I could take a look at them and actually know where my father was flying on certain different days of the year. The last entry is for May the 30th of 1943, about 4 years, 4 days rather, from just 4 days away. And I found it interesting to be able to look over the history and learn a few things about my father, because we never actually met. He was killed 2 months before I was born. This weekend, brethren, around the country, people will be gathering to pay tribute and to commemorate with honor those who died in two world wars in the cause of freedom. But today in this sermon, I would like to pay tribute of a different kind, to pay tribute to the God who made the victories possible. Now, people will pay tribute to the dead, and I do not wish to take away from that. Many brave men and women gave their lives in the cause of freedom. But I do want in this sermon to make it clear that Germany could have won the war if it had not been for God's intervention. After the war, there were those who wanted to take the credit to themselves. The British were the most important in winning the war. The Americans were the most important, or the Air Force or the Army. But in reality, brethren, the most important element, of course, was God himself. Let's turn to Psalm 18, and beginning in verse 34. A recognition that David had, as a man of war, of where his victories came from. Of course, God is not in favor of war, brethren. He would not allow David to build his temple of peace, because he said David was a man of blood. But God did use David to extend the boundaries of ancient Israel and to lay the foundations for the building of the temple and make provisions for the great reign of Solomon that would be a type of the millennial reign of Jesus Christ. But with regard to his wars and to his battles, David made this observation. Verse 32 of Psalm 18. It is God that girds me with strength and makes my way perfect. He makes my feet like hinds' feet and sets me upon my high places. He teaches my hands to war, so that a bow of steel is broken by my arms. You have also given me the shield of your salvation, and your right hand has holden me up, and your gentleness has made me great. You have enlarged my steps under me, that my feet did not slip. I have pursued my enemies and overtaken them. Neither did I turn again till they were consumed. I have wounded them that they were not able to rise. They are fallen under my feet. For you have girded me with strength unto the battle. And time again, brethren, through Israel's history, that most certainly has been the case. In the last few centuries, from the Spanish Armada to the Battle of Trafalgar to the Battle of Waterloo, God has been with his people Israel. But perhaps at no time in all of our history has the hand of God been more plain than at the time of the Second World War. And as you study the events of that war, brethren, one thing becomes abundantly plain. Germany could have, should have, won the war. In fact, if Hitler had allowed it, his generals would have won the war for him, as we will see. I would like to examine, at the first part of this sermon, six errors of military strategy committed by Hitler. And in each one, we will see the hand of God and his intervention to save his people from the jackboot. Now, the last sermon I gave to you related to Mother's Day, so that was basically of interest to the ladies. So this sermon, dealing with military history, will be more for the men and of more interest to them. But we do have to keep things even in our sermons, brethren, so there's no sexual discrimination going on with regard to whom we preach. Let's examine six major errors of military strategy committed by Hitler. Four of them involve Britain to the west of Europe, of course, and two of them involve Russia to the east. The first one that I would like to deal with of the six is Dunkirk. 49 years ago today, the miracle of Dunkirk was unfolding. From May the 26th through June the 4th, a period of 10 days, the evacuation took place. But before that, on May the 10th of 1940, the German Blitzkrieg had begun through the Ardennes north of the Maginot Line. The Maginot Line, brethren, was, as many of you I'm sure understand, a line built by the French as a defense of their border against Germany. But the Maginot Line only extended a certain distance because, of course, Belgium also had a border with Germany and the Netherlands. The Germans had invaded Holland. It took them only 4 days to bring Holland to surrender. And then they struck north of the Maginot Line, going through the Ardennes forest of Belgium into France. The British Expeditionary Force was in this area. There were two German armies, one coming down from this section further north, one coming down from the south, south of through the Ardennes here. And the British Expeditionary Force was caught between them in a pincer movement. In fact, as they raced for Dunkirk, the Germans were ahead of the British. The British Expeditionary Force had been cut off from the French army. And these two German armies came to a point when they were only 9 miles apart, and the British army was still 25 miles from Dunkirk. The British Expeditionary Force was almost completely surrounded by these two German armies and would have had to surrender. It would have been defeated. At that point, brethren, came one of the most amazing orders in all of military history. Hitler told his two armies to halt in their tracks and to let the British go through that 9-mile gap to Dunkirk. Now, people have wondered why in the world a person would make such an unbelievable decision at that point in history when the British were really helpless and were trapped by these two German armies. Hitler's order was, brethren, that Dunkirk was to be left to the Luftwaffe. Goering convinced Hitler that it was better that the Air Force defeat this British army rather than the two German armies under von Rundstedt and Guderian, because not all the German generals were card-carrying Nazis. And Goering felt it better that the Luftwaffe received the credit for the victory. At that point, God intervened with the weather. The bad weather on land grounded the Luftwaffe, but on the channel, it became like a sea of glass covered with fog. And about 1,000 ships, small and large, sailed across the channel from England, and over a period of 10 days, they were able to evacuate nearly 350,000 men. The vast majority of the British army was over there in Europe. And if Britain had lost its British expeditionary force, the war at that point for Britain would have almost certainly been over. Von Rundstedt later made the comment, "My hands were tied by direct orders from Hitler himself. While the English were clambering onto ships off the beaches, I was kept useless outside the port, unable to move. The two German armies had to sit there and watch the English escape. I sat outside the town watching the English escape while my tanks and infantry were prohibited from moving. The entire British army, brethren, could have been destroyed or captured." Let's turn to Psalm 124. Psalm 124. And as a point of interest, I think I'll mention to you that the British, knowing the gravity of the situation, were called to a day of national prayer by King George VI. It was the Sunday before Dunkirk that the nation filled the churches of the land to ask for his intervention. And God answered that with the miracle of Dunkirk. Psalm 124. "If it had not been the Lord who was on our side, now may Israel say, if it had not been the Lord who was on our side when men rose up against us, then had they swallowed us up quick when their wrath was kindled against us. Then the waters had overwhelmed us, the stream had gone over our soul, and the proud waters had gone over us. Blessed be the Eternal who has not given us as a prey to their teeth." The British army was a sitting duck. And yet, verse 7, "Our soul is escaped as a bird out of the snare of the fowlers." And that is a very precise description, symbolically, of Dunkirk. The snare is broken, and we are escaped. Our help is in the name of the Eternal, who made heaven and earth. Now, even though the British had been able to evacuate their army, brethren, remember they were still in retreat. And this brings us to the second major error in military strategy by Hitler, the invasion of Britain, which could have come at this point and never did. Because even though 350,000 men had been evacuated to England, Hitler could have still conquered the nation at this point, but he failed to follow up his strategic advantage. Because after Dunkirk, the British were very much at his mercy. You see, Britain had sent most of her elite divisions across the Channel. And when they left, when they returned to England, they came back without their equipment. They had to leave it on the beaches of Dunkirk. The Germans were able to collect all these armaments and all these weapons for free. So we had 250,000 men, soldiers, returning to the country, but they were unarmed individuals now. All our weaponry had been left behind in France. All England had left to fight an invading force was 100 tanks and about 3 poorly equipped divisions ready for battle. True, they had those other divisions of the expeditionary force, but they were now unarmed for the most part. The elite divisions had been sent over. Only about 3 poorly equipped divisions remained in the land. A German intelligence report declared that at this point, the German army could land and keep supplied 45 divisions on an initial landing of invasion, and then could add another 65 divisions as soon as air superiority was established. This, brethren, would have given the Germans more than a 30-to-1 superiority in armed men and equipment. The situation was so bad that in secret session speeches that came to light after the war, Churchill said, "In 1940, an invading force of perhaps only 150,000 hand-picked men from Germany would have created mortal havoc in our midst." But once again, Hitler decided that the Luftwaffe should do the job. The Luftwaffe had not been able to pick off the British at Dunkirk, so now he was going to allow them to destroy the British Air Force before the invasion. And the Luftwaffe outnumbered the RAF 3 or 4 to 1 at this point. Which brings us to the third error in military strategy by Hitler. And this one deals with the Battle of Britain. The Luftwaffe began its operation to wipe out the RAF by bombing its airfields, its airfield aircraft factories, its 12 radar outposts, and what were called the 7 sector control centers. Now, Goering, who was in charge of the Luftwaffe, did not realize how important the radar outposts were to British defenses, so he soon stopped the attacks on them. However, by September of 1940, 6 of 7 of the all-important sector stations were knocked out, the communications that kept the RAF up in the air. In other words, the entire communication system was on the verge of destruction. Churchill referred to it as Britain's darkest hour. And he said that in the fighting between August 24th and September 6th, the scales had tilted against our fighter command. There was much anxiety. If this Battle of Britain continued a few more weeks, the RAF would go under despite the gallant efforts of many of the pilots. True, they were shooting down the Luftwaffe 2 to 1, we were losing 1 for every other 2, but they outnumbered us 3 or 4 to 1. And without our sector stations, and with a constant bombing of the airfields and aircraft factories, before long, the RAF would just not have the manpower, the pilots, or the aircraft to continue the battle in the air. So at this point, Prime Minister Winston Churchill gambled on a desperate move. He decided to strike back at Germany by bombing Berlin itself. Hitler, in retaliation, ordered that London should be bombed. And he diverted the efforts of the Luftwaffe to destroy the British aircraft and the British airfields. He diverted them to bombing instead the cities as a revenge for the British bombing Berlin. And so the bombing of the airfield stopped just when victory was in the grasp of the Luftwaffe. The bombing of London, it was a terrible price in human life, but it gave the British time to recoup and to rebuild their air force and help them to win the Battle of Britain. As Churchill said afterwards, because of those brave men, and many of them died in the sky, "Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few. But it was God who turned it around, that Hitler changed his strategy and started to bomb the cities instead of the airfields." Sir Hugh Dowding, Commander-in-Chief of the British Fighter Command, made this statement: "I say with absolute conviction that I can trace the intervention of God not only in the battle itself, but in the events which led up to it. And if it had not been for this intervention, the battle would have been joined in conditions which, humanly speaking, would have rendered victory impossible." In other words, this man, Commander-in-Chief of the British Fighter Command in the air, said, if it had not been for the intervention of God, the Battle of Britain would have been lost. Victory would have been impossible. So Hitler, again, in essence, brethren, won the war for us, if you look at it in that light. The fourth error in judgment on the part of Hitler. This involves the conquest of the Mediterranean. Despite these three mistakes, Germany could have yet won the war against Britain. The German General Staff presented Hitler with this plan. They planned to capture the Mediterranean area to cut off what they referred to the British lifeline from Gibraltar to Suez and to starve out the island of Britain. Now, we'll get to God's miracles of the weather a little later on, but in 1941, at the end of 1941, Britain was in serious trouble where food shortages were concerned. The U-boats were already doing tremendous damage to Allied shipping in the Atlantic. As I said, at the end of 1941, Britain was in serious danger from lack of food. The proposal of the German General Staff was to send three army groups to control the Mediterranean. The first one, with the assistance of the Spanish, was to come through France. And remember, there was a fascist government here in France, Spain rather, at this time. The Germans, with the help of the Spanish, this first army would come down here, take over Gibraltar. The second army would come down through Hitler, and of course Italy was allied with Germany, down into Libya and take over this section of Africa, also taking the British island of Malta while they were about it. The third army was to come down through Turkey, down through the Middle East, to take over Suez, and also to take over the oil fields in this area. This was the British lifeline, which flowed through this gateway of the Suez, via Malta, through Gibraltar, and up through Britain. And foodstuffs, of course, came from Australia, from India, as well as the stuff that was coming across from America, across the Atlantic. As I mentioned earlier, the U-boats were doing tremendous damage to Allied shipping here. And the Germans felt, by these three movements, they could take over the Mediterranean and do further damage to the British lifeline. It was, brethren, an excellent plan. And the indications are that it would have worked. But once again, Hitler came to our rescue. He rejected the General Staff's carefully made plans to conquer the Mediterranean. He wanted to knock out Russia first. And Russia, of course, had a non-aggression pact with Germany at this point. So there was no really good reason for taking on Russia. He should have defeated Britain first, got himself fully established on the West Coast, and then gone after Russia. But he expected to defeat Russia in only 10 weeks. And then, after defeating Russia, he said, "The British will surrender. They are already whipped," was his comment. In other words, he felt the Mediterranean plan was not necessary to bring the British to their feet. Field Marshal Keitel of the German army said later on, "Instead of attacking Russia, we should have strangled the British Empire by closing the Mediterranean. The first step in the operation would have been the conquest of Gibraltar. That was another great opportunity we missed." The German General Guderian: "The presence of 4 to 6 panzer divisions in North Africa in 1940 would have given us such overwhelming superiority that any British reinforcements would inevitably have arrived too late." He also stated, "The weakness of the British in Egypt at that time was known to us, and the defenses of the island of Malta against air attack were inadequate." But Hitler decided that he would let the Italians, who were weaker than he thought, conquer Africa and the Mediterranean. So the Italians invaded from North Africa, and there was a seesaw war between them and the British, and the Italians were not able to accomplish the closing of the Mediterranean. They were too weak to do so. Now we come to the fifth error in strategy by Hitler. We've already mentioned it. It's the Battle of Russia. The Blitzkrieg against Russia began in June of 1941, and Stalin's Red Army was taken by complete surprise. The Nazi success was astonishing, brethren. They went on three fronts with 3 million men, and Hitler's estimate of 10 weeks was a good one. Germany could have reached Moscow within that time. Their success, as I say, was astonishing. Nearly 4 million prisoners were taken by the Germans in the first few weeks. In fact, many hundreds of thousands just surrendered to the Germans, particularly the Ukrainians, because many Russian people welcomed the Germans as liberators from communism. Whole divisions of the Red Army defected to the German army. In fact, a Ukrainian army of 800,000 men surrendered to the Germans and pleaded to be allowed to fight against the hated communists. Germany was given ready-made armies to help them defeat Russia itself. But Hitler absolutely refused. He was not going to use these inferior people, whom he regarded as people to be disposed of, and so he would not allow it. Of these 800,000 men in the Ukrainian army, they were left in camps to freeze, to starve, and to eat each other. Cannibalism became rife. If Hitler had accepted their help, Russia would have collapsed. A German diplomat wrote in October of 1942, his name Dr. Otto Brattigam, "The population greeted us with joy as liberators and placed themselves at our disposal. But the barbaric treatment of the Russians turned them against the Nazis." This diplomat, German diplomat, went on to say, "Our policy has forced both Bolshevists and Russian nationalists into a common front against us." So again, Hitler could have won. But through errors in military strategy, did not do so. And yet, despite not using the Ukrainians and the other Russians that surrendered to them and wanted to fight against the communists, Hitler still could have captured Moscow by the fall, except for the sixth and the final blunder that I want to deal with in this section of the sermon. The Germans attacked in three areas, brethren, 3 million men. The first army was to head for Leningrad and take over this section here. The second, to come to Moscow, defeat Moscow. The third, to go through the Ukraine and take over Kiev. As the Germans were advancing and getting close to Moscow, Hitler sent out an order that this army that was advancing on Moscow was to withdraw back nearly 300 miles to join with the army here and attack Kiev. He did this against the advice of all his generals on the general staff there in Berlin. But he said, "My generals know nothing of the economic aspects of war. The Ukraine was the breadbasket of Russia. And he wanted to make sure he got Kiev so he could control the Ukraine to have food to come back to Germany." So he withdrew his troops from Moscow, sent them down here to speed up the taking of Kiev, and then sent these tired troops back to their original assignment to take over Moscow. Now those troops still fought a tremendous battle and actually managed to get right to the outskirts of Moscow. But then came the counterattack of Marshal Zhukov. In that year, Kiev was taken in mid-October. But the Russian winter rains came a month earlier than normal. In mid-October instead of mid-November, the Germans found themselves bogged down in mud. And about the 20th November began the worst winter in 100 years. The Nazis were clothed in only their summer uniforms. Frostbite caused more casualties than the Russians. You see, brethren, as we understand now, I think, by these six errors in military strategy, the German generals would have won the war if they had not been hamstrung by Hitler. And December of 1941 was the beginning of the end for Germany. On December the 6th, Marshal Zhukov began the Russian counterattack, and the Germans were never able to reach Moscow. And so, in the east, the tide changed. And the day afterwards, December the 7th, came Pearl Harbor in the west, and America entered the war. So December of 1941, brethren, spelled the death knell of Hitler's Third Reich. True, the war would go on for four more years, but the tide was now changed both in the east and in the west. Those 2 days, December 6th and December 7th. Now, if Hitler had conquered Britain and had conquered Russia, and as we've seen, he could have done it, both Britain and Russia, he then planned for Germany later on to invade the United States by way of Greenland and northern Canada, and the plan also included Japan to invade the West Coast and Alaska. The Japanese would have also attacked Russia on their East Coast. So clearly, brethren, had God not intervened, Germany would have won the war. And it's not just a question of Hitler's mistakes militarily. We can take a look at a couple of other examples here, brethren, of God's intervention. Quirks of fate, they might be called by people in this world, but they were really the hand of God. Let's take the famous sinking of the Bismarck. The Bismarck, that huge vessel, menaced Allied ships between Iceland and Greenland. And in May of 1941, two British battle cruisers, the Hood and the Prince of Wales, found the Bismarck and took her on. The Hood was sunk to the bottom of the sea. The Prince of Wales was badly damaged. From that point on, the British sought revenge. They went hunting the Bismarck. It became a question of pride, and of course the Bismarck was the pride of the German Navy. But finally, they caught the Bismarck 400 miles off the coast of France. So they brought up the ships they could to attack her. A lucky torpedo, lucky in quotes, severely damaged the steering gear of the Bismarck. And that sounded the death knell for it. True, all her guns were intact, but with her steering gear damaged, she could not escape those British ships. As in consequence, the British fleet was able to send her to the bottom. But I'd like to read to you the comment of Admiral Sir John Tovey, who was Commander-in-Chief at that time of the Home Fleet. He says, "For a long time I have been a great believer in prayer. In the last few weeks," this were the weeks they were chasing the Bismarck, "I have prayed as I have never prayed in my life. If anyone had said that we could meet the Bismarck, as they did 400 miles off France, that great ship with her main armament of 9-inch and 15-inch guns unimpaired, and come out of the action without the loss of a single British life, no one would have believed him. It is incredible. It can be attributed to only one thing. I firmly believe that the result of this action was due to divine guidance and intervention." Another example, brethren. This appeared in the Reader's Digest some years back, entitled "A Drink That Made History." I mentioned to you earlier, brethren, of the plan of the German General Staff to take over the Mediterranean, to cut off the British lifeline through these two gateways God had given us of Suez and Gibraltar. Hitler had decided that he would go into Russia instead, and the defeat of Russia, he felt, would cause the British to surrender. He said the Italians should be allowed to invade North Africa and take on the British in Egypt. But when the Italians came down, it was a seesaw affair. The Italians were not able to really gain the foothold that had been intended. And so Hitler sent down Rommel and the Africa Corps to take on the British. And of course, Rommel was perhaps the most brilliant of all the German generals. And he pushed the British back further and further into Egypt until they came to the line of El Alamein, about 60 miles from Alexandria. Rommel's troops had been so victorious up to this point that even before they got to Alexandria, Hitler ordered that medals should be struck in honor of this great victory that was to come, in his mind, just a few days later. Now, there were two battles of El Alamein, brethren. The more famous one is the one that Montgomery fought. But the first one, the first battle of El Alamein, is the one that I want to deal with in 1942. Rommel's Africa Corps were held by General Auchinleck at El Alamein, and the battle there, this first battle of Alamein, was touch and go. But finally, the Africa Corps gave way and began to withdraw. There was a major there, a man named Major Rainier, and he relates in the Reader's Digest what took place. As the battle broke off, an astonishing thing happened. More than 1,100 Germans walked across to our lines with their hands in the air. Now, they didn't need to surrender. They hadn't been defeated. They'd just broken off the engagement. Thirst had done it. For 36 hours, they had had no fresh water to drink. A pipeline full of salt water was the cause. They had found and gleefully tapped it. The seawater in it had increased their thirst almost to the point of delirium. They'd found this pipeline, assumed that it was drinking water, had drunk it, but it was salt water. As he went on to say, for 1,100 of them to surrender when escape lay open to them, that was nothing short of a miracle. And then he goes on to explain why on that one day of the year, that one day alone, there was salt water in that pipeline. Why was that pipeline full of salt water? As the officer responsible for supplying the 8th Army with water through all its desert campaigns, I can give you the answer. The pipeline was a new one, and I never wasted precious fresh water in testing a line. I always used salt water. If the panzers had punched through Alamein the day before, that pipeline would have been empty, and they would have gone elsewhere for their water. 2 days later, it would have been full of fresh water. As it happened, the Nazis got the salt water on the one day of the year when salt water was going through it. And they didn't detect the salt at once because their sense of taste had already been anesthetized by the brackish water they had been used to and by thirst. The balance of that crucial desert battle was so even that I believe the enemy, without that salted torture, might have outlasted us. And then defenseless Alexandria would have fallen into their hands. On so small a turn of fate is history written. But again, brethren, it was the hand of God. So we've seen Hitler's errors. We've seen what would be called quirks of fate in the favor of the British. And of course, in this next section, I'd like to return to the weather. I mentioned to you Dunkirk, brethren, and how the turn in the weather saved the British Expeditionary Force. That's only one example how God frequently intervened with the weather in our favor to help us out. Weather there at Dunkirk that was bad on the land and ground of the Luftwaffe, and yet was good on the channel, allowing 1,000 or more ships to come across and evacuate 1/3 of 1,000,000 men. But at the end of 1941, because of what the U-boats have been doing at the in the Atlantic, Britain, as I mentioned earlier, was in danger from lack of food. We could have been starved into submission if the weather had been against us. And this is why the German plan to take over the Mediterranean and cut off our lifeline through there was such a good one. Yet in 1942 came the miracle of the bumper harvest, the biggest harvest that Britain had ever known. And again, the hand of God, brethren. With different landings in North Africa, Casablanca, Morocco, and the invasion of Sicily. Before they invaded Sicily, there was a great gale. And then suddenly there was a lull at 0 hour that allowed them to disembark their troops and begin the invasion of Europe from the south. We've already talked about the Russian winter, brethren. But another example is D-Day on June the 6th of 1944. The weather had been bad. And the German meteorologist has said that it would be bad throughout June the 6th, and so the expected invasion would not take place at that point. So when the Allied forces landed in France, they found many German troops without officers, and other enemy coastal units were having exercises at the time of the Allied landing. Now, Rommel had said, because at this point Hitler had assigned Rommel to the Western Front to withstand any invasion from the Allies, Rommel had made the statement that with regard to the Allied invasion, the first 24 hours would decide its fate. Whether it would be a failure or a success would be decided in the first 24 hours. But Rommel said it will be the longest day. And of course they made a movie later on based on Rommel's statement called The Longest Day. After the war was over, obviously. When it came, because of the weather forecast, Rommel himself was back home with his wife. Because by coincidence, his wife's birthday was June the 6th. And because of the weather forecast, as we've seen, quite a few of the German troops were certainly not expecting an invasion, and many officers had gone away and left their troops, not feeling that any invasion would come at that point. So again, brethren, God intervened with the weather, going against all the forecasts of the meteorologists and providing the Allies with the weather that they needed to make their landing and their invasion of Europe. On the eve of D-Day, King George VI broadcast this message to the British people. 4 years ago, our nation and empire stood alone against an overwhelming enemy with our backs to the wall, tested as never before in our history. And I mentioned, brethren, earlier on that perhaps the hand of God has never been so apparent as it was in the Second World War. Tested as never before in our history, in God's providence, we survived that test. Now once more, a supreme test has to be faced. This time the challenge is not to fight to survive, as it had been during the Battle of Britain, but to fight to win the final victory for the good cause, that we may be worthily matched with this new summons of destiny. I desire solemnly to call my people to prayer and dedication. We are not unmindful of our own shortcomings, past and present. We shall ask not that God may do our will, but that we may be enabled to do the will of God. And we dare to believe that God has used our nation and our empire as an instrument for fulfilling his high purpose. Our God answered the prayers of the people once again, as he'd answered them at Dunkirk. So we see, brethren, in three areas, with regard to miracles of the weather, with regard to seeming tricks of fate, the Bismarck, the Alamein main pipeline, and Hitler's military errors, that God won the war for us. And yet, even despite Hitler's blunders and military errors, he could have still won the war. Despite all that I showed you there, brethren, with the four things with Britain and the two in Russia, Hitler could have still won the war if Germany had created the atom bomb first. And the Germans were working on it at the same time as the Allies. They were working on it in Norway at a place called Norsk Hydro in the town of Vemork in 1942. The Germans, of course, before it invaded Norway and taking it over. And at that place was the world's largest electrochemical plant. But with the help of God, the Norwegians and the British were able to blow up that hydroelectric plant. Later, of course, in the war came the accidental Allied bombing of Peenemünde, where they were again preparing for an atomic bomb. And so it was that God allowed the Allies to win the race to the atom bomb. Because if Germany had had it, and remember he designed his V-1 rockets and his V-2 rockets, if he'd had the atom bomb, he could have blown what was left of London out of existence and any other major cities within the range of those V-2 rockets. I mentioned to you, brethren, that the tide turned against Germany and Russia on December the 6th of 1941, and then came Pearl Harbor the day afterwards in 1941. But also on December the 6th, the day before Pearl Harbor, something else happened in the West. On that day, President Roosevelt gave approval for what was later called the Manhattan Project. The day before Pearl Harbor, God allowed to be set in motion what would produce the atomic bomb and end the war with Japan. So you see, brethren, on December the 7th, Japan began its war with the United States. But the day before, God had set in motion the program that would bring an end to the war with Japan later on. Let's turn, brethren, to Isaiah chapter 10, and beginning in verse 3. Isaiah chapter 10, and beginning in verse 3. After the war, General MacArthur said, "We have had our last chance. If we will not devise some more equitable way, Armageddon will be at our door." Now, the more equitable way, brethren, should be that we, the people of Israel, repent and turn to God and start to obey His commandments, that the upcoming war should not be necessary. Truly, the Second World War was our last chance. But we haven't changed. We haven't learned the lessons. The hand of God was abundantly evident to help us and to save us from defeat. And so this time, brethren, God is not going to help us again. Because we haven't learned the lesson, we're going to have to learn it the really hard way by being defeated by a German-led Europe. Isaiah 10, and beginning in verse 3. "What will you do in the day of visitation, and in the desolation which shall come from far? To whom will you flee for help, and where will you leave your glory? Without me they shall bow down under the prisoners, and they shall fall under the slain." And this time, brethren, truly, we will be without God. Lamentations chapter 2. Lamentations chapter 2, and beginning in verse 3. Lamentations chapter 2, beginning in verse 3. "He has cut off in his fierce anger all the horn of Israel. He has drawn back his right hand from before the enemy." In the last war, God's right hand was in front of the enemy, preventing the invasion of Britain. But this time, God is going to withdraw his hand, and the Anglo-Saxon peoples are going to go down to defeat. "And he," God, "burned against Jacob like a flaming fire, which devoured round about. He has bent his bow like an enemy." God, who was our friend in two world wars, is to be our enemy in the third. He stood with his right hand as an adversary and slew all that were pleasing to the eye in the tabernacle of the daughter of Zion. He has poured out his fury like fire. So we are going to lose, brethren, the next war. Which brings us to a question relating to those who will be honored over this Memorial Day weekend. Those who gave their lives in two wars for liberty and freedom and to deliver mankind from tyranny. Did they die in vain? If we are to be defeated in this next war, and we are, did they die in vain? Now you can go visit a military cemetery, and there's one here in San Bruno, and you can stand there, as I did one time last year, among the rows and rows of markers of graves, all of them lined up with military precision, and each row a different year in which the people died. Thousands upon thousands of them. As you stand there and look over those rows of graves, you think what a terrible waste it all was. All those people, brethren, if you look at it from a spiritual standpoint, did die in vain. None of this was necessary. If man had obeyed God from the beginning, we needed not to have had any of the wars that have ravaged society through the 6,000 years gone past. War is hell, and it truly is absolutely unnecessary. But man chose that way. Nevertheless, if we look at it from a human standpoint, we know that God gave the victory, but many brave men and women died to help that victory come to pass. There's a quotation I would like to read to you from General Eisenhower at the conclusion of the war. He gave this message to the Allied troops, and it brings to mind what I saw at that military cemetery in San Bruno last year. He says, "The route you have traveled through hundreds of miles is marked by the graves of former comrades. Each of the fallen died as a member of the team to which you belong, bound together by a common love of liberty and a refusal to enslavement. Let us have no part in the profitless quarrels in which other men will inevitably engage as to what country, what service won the European war." And as we've seen, brethren, it was God, not man, who won the war for us. Nevertheless, he used these people in their ignorance of God's ways. Every man, every woman of every nation here represented has served according to his or her ability, and the efforts of each have contributed to the outcome. This we shall remember, and in doing so, we shall be revering each honored grave and be sending comfort to the loved ones of comrades who could not live to see this day. One time in England, brethren, in 1977, I was able to visit the grave of my father. My mother had taken me there when I was at the age of 12. She remarried 4 years after my father's death, and she did not want my stepfather to know that we were going to visit the grave, so we'd gone up north to visit relatives where the grave was, and while my father was with other people, she took me there to show it to me that one time, because she wanted me to know it was there. But because my stepfather had wanted to marry my mother before she had married my father, she didn't want to hurt his feelings by making him aware of the fact that she was going back to her first husband's grave. I never got the opportunity to go again because my parents never took me until I returned myself in 1977 and tried to learned something of my father and retraced certain steps in that town of Harrogate, Yorkshire, which by English standards is a long way north of where my present parents live. They live close to London. But as I stood there before his grave, I considered the time when he will come up in the resurrection. And I hope when he comes up that I've been faithful in this era that I can be there to meet him when he does. And as my Father was willing to give his life to deliver mankind from tyranny, as it says on that scroll, hopefully he will have a certain pleasure in the fact that his Son followed in his footsteps, not to join a military service and to fight physical soldiers, but to serve in the great work of God and to fight a spiritual enemy, Satan. Because as we read in Ephesians, brethren, we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the principalities of the powers of darkness. What we are engaged in, brethren, is a far greater cause than that for which they fought. We owe them a debt, yes, if we look at it from a human, physical standpoint. They were brave men and women who gave their lives. And in their minds, it was truly a great cause. But ours is the greater cause, brethren, that we have been called to. Not to die on a battlefield, but to live for God and for his work, and thereby to serve all mankind. And in the future, when Jesus Christ returns, to help deliver mankind from Satan and from the ways of Satan. Winston Churchill, at the beginning of the war, made a very famous speech to the British people in their hour of darkness about fighting on the beaches, fighting on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields, in the streets. We shall fight on the hills. You've all heard it. But he ended that speech this way, with this sentence. We shall never surrender. And even if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it was subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old. Well, we, brethren, are the pioneers of a new world, the harbingers, the heralds of a new order. And when this world enters the next great dark age and our people are in captivity, at the return of Jesus Christ, we, the representatives of the new world, will step forth to rescue our people and liberate them from the old world and its ways. We're not delivering mankind from a tyranny of a Hitler. We're delivering mankind from the tyranny of Satan. And when our fathers come up in the resurrection, many of them died in this war not knowing the outcome. They died not knowing whether their dream of liberation for the peoples of the earth was fulfilled. They were fighting the tyranny. They fought for peace. They fought for freedom. But they died not knowing if their dream had been fulfilled, because they died before the war ended. But when they come up in that resurrection, they're going to find that their dream was fulfilled beyond their wildest expectations, and that we, their children, called into the Church of God, had a part in creating a world without war, a world without human misery and suffering and oppression. They did not die in vain, brethren. We, their children, though they know it not, we are going to fulfill their dream for them in a far greater way than they ever conceived of.